So picture this. You submit some code to an open source project. I might actually want to be on the right script.
No, that is the right
No,
script.
I think
Huh?
you're doing great.
That's a hang jury.
That's a hang jury, I know.
Let's try this again in the right spot. Anthropic won a landmark case for fair use. Then they had to cough up a cool $1.5 billion. This week, a judge approved the largest AI copyright settlement on record. Authors get a few thousand dollars for their pirated work. Anthropic destroys the files. And here's the part that doesn't quite add up. Their lawyers won the fair use argument, so why did they have to pay billions anyway? This is a tech hangout, so let's get into it. And this is the part where I introduce you to my lovely, lovely panel here on the Tech Hangout. We are sharp as ever today. Well, from the mean state of Colorado, we have Mr. Jeff Gamet.
Mr. Ben Rathig, I'm so proud of you for finding the right part in the script and getting through it. I probably wouldn't have even had the right document open. So well done. And yeah, wildfire smoke is down a little bit for today, but it's still early. That could change.
And let's go to now someone whose house does not smell like a campfire, Marty Jensius.
Hey, wait a minute. You guys get Misters, and I just get Marty Jensius. Actually, it's Reverend Dr. Marty Jensius, if you want to be correct. I'm doing fine. I just went through about an hour on the phone suffering through the American healthcare system and basically the insurance American healthcare system, where I had to do everybody else's job. That's been fun. So I'm spitting tacks today.
Marty,
Yeah,
this
you're
is the
going to have to
tech
see a doctor
hangout.
about that. Hope you have a good coping.
A
Marty, this is the
specialist.
tech ha this is the tech hangout, not a horror show.
That's Reverend Doctor,
And
by the way.
yeah, Reverend Doctor. And now we go to the man with an unbelievable polo collection, Senor Chuck Joyner.
Senor, I was waiting for just hey you. I mean, after Reverend Doctor, just hey you in the pink shirt.
Oh, it's either that or Polo Boy.
Wow, tough group.
There's an OnlyFans site right there, Polo Boy.
Oh my gosh, hold on. Let's do a
Hold
Google search right now.
on. That's the only Chuck's burner account.
Oh, the burner account. Good. Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I was doing fine up until this conversation, and then it's just gone right down the tubes.
And lastly, the person who never goes down the tubes, Ms. Patrice Brendamore.
I'm not so sure about that. I might go down the tube sometimes.
Public
Usually to take a
transportation,
train,
right?
exactly. Yes.
Yeah, or in a lake behind a boat.
No. More an airplane in this case.
Or down the mountain on it on a
Yeah,
tube in
that
the
could also
snow.
be. Yeah, that could also be. Yeah.
Yep, and for those who don't know me, I am Ben Rithick, your host. So let's get it right into the feed here. And you know what? Let's have Marty tell us about his iPhone panels.
This is a article that came out of, well, Mac Rumors, but it's been repeated through the day. I get up in the morning on Friday morning and look at the feeds and see what the latest is that comes out, and if it's something that I think is tech hangout worthy, I'll throw it up there. But basically, Apple is making some attempts to get 20% reduction in cost price for the iPhone 18 Pro Max. And they're looking at the OLED panel and trying to decrease the cost of that. And I just think it's interesting that companies, particularly with the purchasing power that Apple has, is able to be able to renegotiate these or negotiate this. And I think this is it is a Samsung display, isn't it? Yeah, Samsung display. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean they're able to go head to head with Samsung to get some reductions on this particular size, the Pro Max size. I'm getting less and less excited about the 18 Pro Max because it's bigger, thicker, and longer. And I'm not sure I want anything bigger, thicker, and longer at this point in my life. So
that's what she said. I'll be,
I was wondering who was going to make the joke. And honestly, you know, my money would have been on Ben.
I was watching Jeff's face.
I was watching Jeff's face, and you could see him struggling not to say it. He was just struggling so hard.
We were all struggling.
I set that one up nice and slow over the center of the plate, expecting something a little more highball in terms of your responses. But instead, what we got was, that's what she said.
Yeah.
Come on, you can do better than that.
Marty, don't judge based only on size. Just work on your flexibility.
Yes.
My hands cannot, hands cannot get around anything bigger. So...
all I'm hearing is you need a friend.
We have completely gone off the topic of the article, which is...
Let's get back to the hard facts of OLED panels.
Yeah, it's interesting
About OLED panels.
It's interesting that Apple's been able to kind of do these negotiations. I think this is comes out as good PR in terms of their attempts to reduce costs. Now, we'll see how that turns out in the long run, but it's still, it's a good optic for Apple.
Yeah, I mean, I think Apple is also trying to squeeze like all the parts manufacturers, especially with memory, anything memory related or chip related being expensive right now. They're of course trying to see where they can maybe reduce the cost to keep the phone more or less the same. Price-wise, or at least in a reasonable range, right? It might be they have to increase the cost or the price, but not as much.
The only thing I'm really hoping is that they continue to go this direction, that they continue to, they squeeze suppliers, but they don't compromise on the quality of the phone.
Yeah, for sure.
Because that has been a hallmark of Apple. And to do that, double the price of the phone, just... keep the quality, because that's where your reputation is. Mm. And we're right back to the discussion of the race to the bottom, you know, that it's not going to do Apple any favors.
Patrice hit on a super important point, which is that Apple probably doesn't want to have an impact on iPhone pricing, if it can avoid it. I'm paraphrasing what Patrice just said. But I think that's absolutely right. My guess is that Apple will do everything they can to avoid increasing iPhone prices.
Yeah.
Or if they have to, mitigate that as much as they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just thinking, how price sensitive is the iPhone market compared to other Apple products? And I think it might be one of the more price sensitive markets, right? Because if people are buying a, let's say, $3,000 to $5,000 MacBook, if it costs $200 to $300 more, maybe in the education market that could be a factor, but I think in the grand scheme of things, probably not very sensitive. But the phone market, because it's such a mass market, really, probably a little bit more sensitive to what's going on in the world and how and price increases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that, and right now the processor in those iPhones is, it literally now is a desktop level processor.
Yes. So it's proven by the MacBook Neo.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Marty. But because of that, most people have a phone in their pocket that is overpowered for what they actually need it for. If they have to cut back, they can use that phone a little bit longer, which is not great for Apple. If they can keep that price down and entice people to buy, keep buying on a cycle, that's really good for the bottom line and the shareholders.
Wait, so you're saying if I need like a bigger phone for my Facebook usage? That's what you're saying?
Yeah. Keep in mind that Apple services and iPhone are symbiotic. Mm-hmm. And the more people you keep in the iPhone part of the ecosystem, the more people you have in Apple's services ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Which and is now... Oh, go ahead, Ben.
Well, go ahead, Ben. No, please.
I was going to say, which is now Apple's second largest product category after the iPhone.
Mm-hmm. And let's face it, I think it's the iPhone is still perceived as the cool phone, the best phone, you know, out there. I think that's fair to say, mm-hmm. especially among younger generations. Yes, I know they're Android fans, but so Apple's iPhone is the kind of the gateway drug into the walled garden, if it still needs one. And so to keep it up to date, to keep it profitable, of course, but to continue to maintain that perception is critical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're pretty much in agreement here. So, Mr. Chuck, let's talk about your Meta.
You know, Meta just came out with an ad, if you will, that is couching them as pro AI. And I think this is, you know, this might be the worst thing could possibly happen to AI is to have Meta go positive for them. But...
It's true.
You know, and Zuckerberg, you know, is posturing it as, you know, we want to help people connect and we want this and we want that. And at the end of the day, Meta's future, a large part of Meta's future, like a lot of the tech companies, is going to rest on the AI. I mean, we have the Meta glasses that you know that he wants to. I mean, I'm sorry, it just I can't prove it, but it's so obvious that he's going to scrape everything he possibly can from there to gain more information about you and what to put in front of you and to sell that information to advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
And that level of data processing is going to require heavy-duty AI. So, of course, he wants to be pro-AI. And it just, once again, it feels more than a little disingenuous. So I think it's worth, you know, pointing that out to people that there are plenty of people that are pro-AI. There are plenty of people that are anti-AI. At the end of the day, it's here. It exists. We got to deal with it.
Okay, Chuck, I'm going to pile on to the tone deafness of Meta's ad by pointing out the song that's playing in the background. It's David Bowie's 5 Years. Oh. It doesn't get much more dystopian than that. It's a song about the end of humanity after some major catastrophe.
But better yet, they could just play the Terminator theme.
Might as well.
Might as well, yeah.
I really love, you could tell the author of this article is just fed up with this doublespeak that Meta does. around it, as the article ends off with. The same company that's being sued by publishers for allegedly training its AI on copyrighted material, the same company that once had an internal policy document that suggested it was permissible for AI chatbots to have sensual conversations with minors. Those guys. It is really... I thought I was spitting tacks today, but this article ends off. And then it talks about justifying the cuts that they said AI caused us to fire all these people. But yeah, let's get into AI, everybody.
What could possibly go wrong?
We literally have a bunch of movies that could, about what could go wrong.
You know, Zuckerberg has really bet his company's future on AI. He's all in on it.
Just like he was all in on the metaverse, you mean?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Patrice. Actually, was it? You beat me to it. Yep.
Yep.
He's Ben, you said it well. He's all in on it until he's all in on something else.
I think the biggest thing to remember here, at its core, Meta is not a product company. They are an advertising company.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you are the product.
If the product does not serve ad sales, they do not have interest in it anymore.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Jeff, are you fining us?
No, he's getting fined.
Yeah, getting fined. And yeah. So here's the deal. Google is they're facing $1 billion or is it €1 billion? Anyhow.
It's €1 billion probably.
Yeah, €1 billion in fines in the EU. And
it's not just that they're facing it. They have to pay because they already lost all the appeals.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So yes, much better way to say it.
Yeah.
So they've been fighting these fines and the rulings. Basically, what it comes down to is Google is being fined €1 billion for doing exactly what Google's business model is, which is to control all of your online search. Yep. And so in this case, we're looking at the way Google has ranked their own things and search results higher than other search results.
It's $1 billion. I just checked. It's actually
$1 billion. So yes. They did the conversion.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So okay. Yeah. So that would that would not be $1,138,689,910.59 if it was €1 billion.
Yes.
So, okay. Now, so we have this, and I could have thrown another article in here with this, but I didn't. The gist of the other article is that Google just keeps clashing with Europe because they've got this going on, and they were also ordered by the European Commission to open up the AI infrastructure in Android so that any other AI platform can hook in just as deeply as Gemini does. And it would essentially give any AI platform unfettered access to every element in an Android device.
If the user decides so, as we discussed last week. I mean, we had the same discussion last week about Apple, and it's literally the same thing.
Yeah. So now Google's in a much bigger fight because Of course, they don't want to pay the $1 billion, and they don't want to give up their control over your search results. And of course, they also don't want to give anyone else the same level of control over AI in Android that they have.
Yeah. So, by the way, the billion breaks down to self-preferencing its own services on Google Search, which is $522 million. And for anti-steering practices like charging fees or restricting app developers from directing consumers to cheaper purchase options outside Google Play, which is another $488
million. That sounds familiar.
Sounds very familiar, yes. I think we've heard these before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not an accident, because it's also, there's only, I think, four companies that even fall under the DMA, and Google is one of them. So it's only four options where that could happen.
Yep, and they're the only other one with a credible mobile operating system.
Mm-hmm.
That's also Jeff, true. I'm glad you threw this in, because this was going to be one I threw in. And then I thought, you know what? We just had this discussion last week just from the Apple angle.
Uh-huh.
But it's the same thing. You know, I don't – at what point is – and I know this article talks about, you know, Trump getting involved. And honest to God, I'm starting to think that I really want that in this in this circumstance. I know. But, you know, it just – it feels like that the EU – is funding themselves by hitting American companies and also stifling competition.
Do you mean like, you know, the US is doing the same thing?
There are places.
Patrice, oh, there's those Patrice is that European apologist that we get
course,
every week.
Of course.
I think
they're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing here is, it's not as if Google didn't know. It's not as if Google didn't have a chance to do something about it. At some point, they get fined. To be honest, I think the billion is not going to hurt Apple that Google that much. Also, I don't think it makes much of a difference in the budget of the EU, to be honest. But at some point, it has to hurt, right? It's like, if not, then just leave it. Then don't have the rules, because what's the point? If Google is like, well, I'm so big, I don't follow rules, then what?
Yeah, I mean, at this point,
we have a president that does this.
Yeah, I know, I know. We don't.
And Jeff,
not yet.
Jeff, please, when you use Google, and you refer to $1 billion, can you do it like the Dr. Evil thing?
$1 billion.
Yeah, okay. I mean, for Google, $1 billion is basically the price for doing business.
Yeah, they pay Apple more than that every year for just search access. Like,
yeah, but you guys are missing the point here, that if this becomes a precedent, then Brazil is going to pop up with it.
Yeah, it already is.
You know, so now we saw it happening with Apple in the App Store.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden every country is jumping on saying, we're going to issue fines, not maybe $1 billion, but all they're doing is just looking for money,
including the US. In the US, the DMA is right now being looked at and to see if that's not something the US should also do, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, the DMA was always going to be a template law.
Yes, I think we knew that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Chuck, hoping that Trump gets involved with the negotiations, what that tells me is that you're ready to watch Google crash and burn, because with his negotiation skills, we will see that $1 billion suddenly become $2 billion, because that's how good he is at negotiating.
Jeff, I unfortunately agree with that. But on the other hand, there's no one out there advocating.
Yeah.
I mean, the question is a bad advocate better than no advocate?
Sometimes,
probably.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes, yes.
Sometimes, yes. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens here.
Yeah.
But you have to advocate for yourself in a situation like this, which is what Apple did. And you know, like with the whole AI thing, Apple's response was, this is what you want us to do. This is not something we can or will do. Therefore, you simply don't get the features that tie in with that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That could happen. I mean, the more realistic path also is this, you know, this is also part politics. Like, this was now the court deciding and the agencies deciding whatever. Usually what happens is that billion, that's the headline, and then, like, at the end, it's whatever, 100 million or something. Gets negotiated down. That's always what happens.
But it means one thing for means one thing for us. More tariffs. I see yeah. more tariffs.
We already got those. It's too late for that.
Yeah.
Nobody cares anymore.
Yeah, it just leaves a bad taste in my mouth when I see this, because it just, especially the arguments of, well, we're helping, you know, competition. Yeah.
But and I think they are.
Come on, Patrice. You know, I really struggle with that. I really struggle with that.
It's a balancing act.
We had that discussion last week. I still think the intent behind it is correct. Is that some part of it is politics? As always in politics, not everything is implemented correctly, and we can argue about that. But I think from a European perspective, I think there is some part where we have to also make sure that we allow fair competition, and I don't think the way the platforms are set up right now, where they basically can do whatever they want, is not the solution. And there is right now no third option, right? I mean, that's the part. If we had three four, then I don't think we would have that discussion.
Yeah, I'm having deja vu.
Deja vu, yeah.
Yes. To quote the great philosopher Pizza the Hut, unfair to the... unfair to the payee, fair to the payor. unfair to the payor, fair to the payee.
Yeah. You know, to me, when I look at this, well, I find heavy government regulation in business activities like this somewhat distasteful. I also remember what we went through with the Microsoft Internet Explorer thing. Yes. In the United States, which to me is a lot like what Google is doing right now. And had the U.S. government not stepped in, what would be the state of internet access web browsing activity today?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'd all be getting .exe hacks from stuff coming in.
Right, and we'd still be waiting for all these articles to load because, you know, Internet Explorer.
Yep.
Definitely. At the same time, it was like, oh, geez, does the government really need to step in? Should they be threatening to rip apart a company? And anytime a government steps in and imposes, you run the risk of it's just completely blowing up.
Yes.
And going horribly wrong.
Yeah, that's it. Just politics.
Jeff, this feels just a little bit different, though, because that was allegedly a core piece of the operating system.
Because that was an American...
Like Gemini.
...decision. No.
Well, Gemini, is Gemini part of an operating system?
Oh, yeah.
At this point, I think for... in Android. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay,
so.
All right.
AI is becoming core as part of the operating systems nowadays.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm thinking desktop. Okay, fair point. Yeah. Fair point. Yeah. But, I want to throw one other thing in, and this just happened yesterday, and it's anecdotal, but long story short, I was showing someone something in a browser, and they were not finding the controls that I was asking them to access. And I said, okay, what browser are you on? And they said, I don't know.
Netscape.
Yeah.
No, but the point, I mean, yeah. And you know, that's like, really? You don't know what browser you're running? So
that's
now this,
pretty
and this
common.
Is some,
it's whatever comes with your operating system.
And it's kind of my point, Jeff, you know, and so, but it just, it blows me away. But the normal people, yeah, they don't see the difference between Safari, Netscape,
Firefox. Netscape, yes.
I'm parroting it. You know, they don't seem to understand the difference and the implications of it.
Yep, they don't.
For what it's worth.
It makes no difference to them.
Yeah, but it also shows the power of the default, right? I mean, if you can control what people use to access, you have a lot of control because they don't know any better. They don't switch to anything else. They just, that's the default.
Yeah.
It's like people, like, I mean, there's this old IT support joke. It's like someone calls and it's like, oh, I deleted the internet. And what they mean is they deleted the shortcut to Internet Explorer, right? But for them, that's the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to AOL.
Yeah.
Oh, good times.
No.
do you want to know what I really wanted to go back to AOL from?
Tell me what you want, what you really, really want.
Rogue hacking AIs.
Oh, that was funny.
Yep. So our good friends over OpenAI were testing a couple of their new models. Kind of looking for bugs, blah, 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 blah. Well, one of them ended up flying the coop, finding a way to get internet access and escape the sandbox, and then stole some credentials and hacked into a much smaller competitor called Hugging Face. After which, good old Sam Altman will have to be saving some face.
So, I mean, here's something to keep in mind with that. I mean, this is the story they're telling.
Yeah.
Given that all the hype that we've had about, Anthropic's like Mythos is so powerful and we have to restrict it and, oh, it's going to like destroy the internet if we don't and all of that, which I think a lot of it is marketing BS. It is a powerful model, but I think a lot of that is hype and marketing BS. I'm very careful with the story that OpenAI is telling here. It might be the truth, or it might also be an interpretation of what really happened. A story they're telling to say, oh, look, our GPT-5.6 Sol model is so powerful, it just broke out on its own. And in reality, that's not what really happened.
I am so with you, Patrice. Yeah. I don't think this is a story of an AI going rogue because it's so powerful. Although, I mean, this is clearly a very powerful model.
Yeah,
I think this is a story of a company that needs to reevaluate its security processes and how it builds its sandboxes.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, ultimately, I wouldn't even consider this going rogue. It did exactly what they wanted it to do. They just didn't realize it was going to figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You guys really are deep into conspiracy theory.
No,
because I can't imagine OpenAI coming out and saying, basically, we lost control. I mean, you talk about tone deaf, Jeff.
It's Sam Altman. Keep that in mind.
It's Sam Altman, but even Sam Altman, I mean, you know, he's not stupid. He may be arrogant, but he's not stupid, and he's got to know that this has got to just. This really looks bad for the whole AI thing. Even worse than Meta's does.
I'm not so sure because, I mean, yes, it looks a little bit bad, but on the other hand, it also shows how capable it is, right? It supposedly broke out of the jail that it was the sandbox system it was in, basically found it on its own information about some vulnerabilities in some 0 days, used that to break into Hugging Face to get more data for the cyber security like measures that it was supposed to do. I mean, that's a good story to tell to say, look, it is so powerful, it can find vulnerabilities in system that are supposedly not vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to clarify, Chuck, when I said it did exactly what they told it to do, I don't mean that they told it hack out of your sandbox and attack Hugging Face.
No,
they told it to like run some experiments on various attack vectors.
Exactly.
Which, which is not
and it didn't thing. And it didn't have the restrictions in place that would have prevented like this the thing that from happening that happened. But as I said, like, my point is not, I'm not sure, I mean, this might have happened exactly like they said, but the way they're telling the story is, as I said, I think it's more about marketing than the actual story.
Yep. Let's ask an AI representative here.
Yeah, for the people listening.
Soul, Saul 5.6, what would you like to tell us about your
acting?
Now it'll say, I'll be back, and it'll head over to the Hugging Face repository again.
Yes. Yeah. Or it'd say, by your command, and go ahead and destroy
us. I thought you were referring to Marty, Ben.
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on this article. I kind of think it's an interesting accident that happened in whatever way it happened. And it wasn't the AI going rogue, or it wasn't necessarily directed to act in that behalf. I think they were just messing around, and it was an accident that showed up. And Chuck, just to note, Tone Deaf Jeff is an indie band from Missouri, by the way.
Yeah.
That's funny.
They play a subgenre of ska.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I forgot. OpenAI is also approaching the IPO, so keep that in mind.
Yes. Yep. Though I think coming up with Skynet Junior might not help
This is really interesting to listen to the different perspectives on this panel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what we do. Might we do this?
Yeah.
If you all agreed, it would be boring.
Yeah, that's why we are a discussions show and not a news show.
True.
Fair point.
Yeah. So, since we're all about people doing stupid things and paying out loads of money,
yes,
let's have Patrice tell us about Anthropic winning and then still doling out the cash.
Yes. So this is an interesting one. So we just talked about Anthropic and like the other big player in the market. They just basically agreed to pay $1.5 billion in a settlement with authors. Billion with a B. So that's more than the EU is asking for. Like, they're just paying it out to authors. So basically, there's been a fight with, I think, about 500,000 authors and publishers in the class action lawsuit, because they were saying that the training that Anthropic did, which they admitted, on printed or published, not printed, published books, like could also be, well, probably was mostly digital books, actually, was illegal. So the whole case was basically, is this fair use? Can they actually train it? All of that. The judge, the interesting part is, as I said, Anthropic will pay $1.5 billion, but not because it's illegal to train the AI on the bot on the books. The judge basically said, the argument that this is basically no different than a human reading books and learning, they agreed with it. So in general, the fair use part is upheld by this. But the point was, they went to illegal sites and downloaded the books illegally. And that was the part where the judge said, well, that you can't do. If they had gone and bought the books legally from some other place, which meant also the authors and publishers would have gotten paid at least a little bit, then we wouldn't have a case. So it's really interesting to say they pay $1.5 billion, which is about, what was it, $3,000 per...
$1,000.
Yeah, per work, basically. The lawyers get another $102 million out of that in fees. So there's another person that got paid, or group. But it's just the interesting thing is to basically say, well, it's legal to train on it, but don't get it from illegal sources.
Yeah, don't steal it.
Don't steal it, which I think, it makes sense.
It's copyright violation.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is at the end. So that's what they're settling. Yeah. There is a couple authors that opted out of that payment because they think they can get more in individual cases. So this is not the end. There's a bunch of other class action lawsuits for other things by other organizations and other groups in the same vein. So this will be interesting to watch. Yeah, but for now, at least, fair, like training AI on books is fair use.
The training AI on books is fair use thing. And okay, I'll take a step back just for full disclosure. I am in this class action lawsuit.
Good.
So at some point,
I was wondering who would be.
Yeah. I am. One of the things that came out of all of this is that if you're using paper, you know, dead tree books, mm-hmm. and you're scanning them, and then destroying the paper books, mm-hmm. that's a much easier defense for fair use. So now we're seeing these distributors, book distributors, suddenly getting, well, not suddenly, it's been happening for a little while now, getting these massive orders for specific types of books, mm-hmm. regardless of what they cost. You know, yeah. They'll be ordering like a million books in an order, mm-hmm. and they all get shipped off to a company that gets paid to cut the spines off and scan all the pages and then destroy the books and give that
massive
data
waste
to the,
of resources. But
yeah. And in some cases, these are like really rare books,
mm-hmm.
and they're just being destroyed.
Mm. Such a shame. Yeah, but it's cheaper than to buy them digitally, I guess. I mean, for some books, it's probably not possible to get them digitally, but it seems to be also cheaper to do that.
That said, I do not think we've heard anywhere near the last of this.
No.
I think this will definitely go into the appellate process.
Well, this one won't.
No,
because they agreed to the settlement. Yeah. But other cases that are like this, sure. I could see long drawn out. I mean, this is pretty long, anyhow. But really long drawn out cases.
Yeah, I mean, for a class action lawsuit like that, it's actually not that long. I think 2 years is not that long. New York Times is having.
You're right.
The New York Times is having one with a bunch of other newspaper publishers against OpenAI and Microsoft. So, this is not the end of it.
Yeah. But just the 2 years, I think, speaks to the reason there was a settlement.
Yeah.
Because the litigation is going to drag out and drag out and drag out and drag out. And it's going to cost a lot of money. And, mm-hmm. We're kind of back to the whole billion thing. You know, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money. But why not pay it off, get done, and move on? You know, instead of being drugged through the press. If nothing else, the PR, the lack of PR will be a huge thing.
Yeah, especially since Anthropic mostly got what they wanted, right? Because the whole thing of is this fair use or not, all the judge says it is. So they're paying $1.5 billion to basically buy the books. But they have to destroy the files that they legally downloaded. But I mean, that's anyway done because they already trained the models with them. I mean, they paid $1.5 billion and they won the case more or less.
They want to clean all this stuff up in the eyes of the press and make it look like they're doing the right thing.
Correct.
They got caught. Now they're trying to demonstrate that they can do the right thing.
I mean, the other thing is here, we now have a legal precedent, kind of guide rails for the other AI companies to follow.
Yeah, I don't know legally from a law perspective how much that is a precedent. There's a quote in here from an adjunct professor at Cardozo School of Law. That he said that the fight whether AI training is fair use is yesterday's war, so maybe it is.
But and I'm not defending this, so let's be real clear on that. But at the time this happened, this question had not been asked before.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, depending on, and with no disrespect intended to Jeff, you know, because he's a member of the class action, he obviously has a feeling about it, but it was an undecided point. And so, you know, now,
that he's clear.
It cost Anthropic $1.5 billion to get it clarified, at least in their case.
More, probably. You know, I mean, legal fees on top of that and so on, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, now there is. And so I think at the very least, this can be argued as a precedent, whether it will have the force of law, whether another judge will disagree.
Yeah.
But it certainly and it goes – I mean, this goes back to discussions we had a while back, that how much of a difference is there between me buying the book, reading the book, and – interpreting that and using the knowledge I get from that book to go out and do things, as opposed to an AI reading the book, taking the knowledge, and getting to do things.
Exactly.
Your mileage
and then may vary. Giving the book to Jeff and letting Jeff read it. I'm saying that is that still fair use? Is that still Jeff is not paying for it. So, yeah.
Marty, that's an interesting question. So what if, I guess, no, because the books had to be destroyed in order to do this, do the scanning. They couldn't be donated. So, okay.
Yes, exactly. That's the point. Like, if I give a book to Jeff, then I don't own it anymore. That's the point. He can read it, but I don't own it.
I can't imagine why 1 million copies of a book would be better than 10 copies of a book and people sitting there with scanners and breaking the spines and doing it that way. It seems like excessive to purchase a ton of books when you basically only need one to do the scanning.
But I think what Jeff meant is not it's a million copies of the same book, it's a million different books simply.
Yes, it's a million different titles. Should have clarified.
Yeah, otherwise you're right. That wouldn't make sense. Like, one is enough.
Marty, the argument about, well, if Chuck has a book and reads it and then gives it to me and I read it, is that still fair use? I've seen people present some actually pretty flimsy arguments that this is why we shouldn't have libraries, because every person that reads a book, they should pay for that
usage.
Exactly.
No, I think that is settled law, which doesn't mean much days, but we've heard that before. It's settled law.
We should stop talking.
So now we go into our lovely portion called the hang jury, a last discussion that we discuss. So picture this: you submit some code to an open source project. It's clean, it works, and yet it's rejected, not for being buggy, but mostly just because you prompted a AI to write it, aka vibe coding. That's what happened this week on Codeberg, a European alternate to GitHub that's run by for free and open source software. The members just voted 158-144, basically 75-25, or, you know, 3-1, to ban what they're calling vibe-coded projects, not low-quality code, not malicious code, just code that where the human contribution was just mostly pressing enter on the AI's output. Their argument isn't that AI code is bad, it's that one person with an AI tool can spin up a project that burns as much server space and commute is an entire community effort with zero actual users, zero people maintaining it, and no one ever coming back to fix anything. They call it the development team of none. One person, a statistical machine, and a ghost protocol that just sits there using resources forever. They also banned any Codeberg data to train AI models, because AI companies crawlers hammer the servers reading every single page variant and get history entry just because or just instead of doing a normal download. So is a nonprofit telling developers they can't use AI tools a reasonable stance for the open source community? Or is this just gatekeeping by people who should just get over themselves? Let's discuss.
Yeah. I brought that story because it's something I've been thinking about. I use Codeberg stuff. I don't use Codeberg directly, but I use their software basically. It's called Forge. And from me personally, I looked at this and I saw those changes. And I mean, on one hand, you can say, well, I mean, it is a community deciding what they want to do, right? This is a community project, like in Germany, it's a group, so. They can decide what they want to host and what they don't want to host. But on the other hand, I think, the reality is vibe-coded projects have their value and for the people who are creating them, and they're fun and whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're basically telling people, you're not the right kind of developer, go away, which is incredibly hostile. So that's why I thought I wanted to have your opinions on this topic.
All right. I look at this from the perspective of someone who came out of printing and publishing industry many years ago. And as I was learning everything I needed to know to be able to work in that industry, I had to learn about what was happening before I really got into that, which means going back to that golden triangle of democratizing publishing, the desktop publishing revolution, where we got the Macintosh, Aldus PageMaker, and Adobe PostScript. And that took the publishing industry and the design industry and changed it from something that is exclusively for the highly trained experts and opened it up so that any of us can make something and then print it, and it made this accessible to so many more people. But at the same time, it created the vibe coding version of creating documents for publishing.
Yeah,
like routinely, we'd get an Excel document where each cell was a business card.
Oh yes,
and they wanted you to print that on a with spot colors on a press. Okay, well, the file is literally unusable for anything in the printing industry, but people didn't understand, and you get stuff like this, or they'd get a copy of Quark Express or PageMaker, and then later InDesign, and they would design a document and expect you to print it and then get angry when you have to, instead of vibe coding it, you have to go back and look at what they want and rebuild it from scratch for them. So when I look at what we're seeing here, okay, yeah, this is a very hostile approach towards developers, but I can also appreciate why there would be the resistance, because they don't want Excel spreadsheets for business cards, if you will.
Yeah,
but it's a fine line to walk.
Yeah,
and telling people, hey, don't vibe code, I think that's wrong. There's so many things we can do ourselves that we couldn't do before, and good for us.
Yeah, I literally have a project that you could call I vibe coded, because it is an experiment where I wanted to not touch the code, so it would not be allowed on their platform. Even though I'm a capable developer and I'll maintain it, and I've actually maintained it, it's on GitHub, I've maintained it for a couple of years now. I started, about 2 years ago with that. So, and it's being used and so on. So I think it's like, but it wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
Yeah, I'm from the camp that says get over themselves. This has not just happened in this industry. It's happened in other industries, as Jeff, tried to point out. And I tried to come up with a parallel kind of story And Jeff did a much better job of sharing that and sharing that dilemma. Mm-hmm. If this is a nonprofit organization, it is. I think is what I read.
Yep.
I don't know what nonprofit laws they fall under, but I think this type of exclusion of a nonprofit organization, at least in the States, would cause a lot of ire and potentially jeopardize their nonprofit status.
I would have to check if they're falling under German law. They're German.
Yeah.
German group. So could be. Yeah.
So I'm sort of torn on this. I sort of see their point. And so there's one piece of the puzzle that I don't have, and that is who is paying for the server space and the bandwidth? Because if it's being cluttered up by if the server space especially is being cluttered up by vibe coded apps that are not being used, they're just sitting there because somebody said, "Oh, I can vibe code an app that will, you know, turn your screen purple." Yeah. You know, that's I understand that. But I also, you know, look at the other part and it's like, okay, so by telling people they can't put vibe coded apps up there, you're potentially depriving an audience that prides itself in sharing a potentially useful option. Now, that means you're going to get into judging. Is my purple screen app, you know, viable or not? I don't know if you allow stuff to be put up there and then after a period of time, if it only has X number of downloads, that you say, sorry, this just is not worthy of being part of the community.
Yeah, that would have been reasonable.
I kind of see both sides, but the vote would indicate that these people are thinking more with their hearts than their heads, the way I interpret it.
Yeah. There's a false equivalency in this, too. They're saying, well, you know, people will vibe code, put stuff up there and never come back and fix it. And that's a problem. Like developers don't do that already.
Exactly.
GitHub all the time.
Yes. I mean, there's projects I've created and then just abandoned. Like, that happens. Yeah. No, you're right. To answer your question, Chuck, because I looked into that, it's being paid by the community members and some supporters, right? So like, they're paying for it more or less themselves. So in a sense, you can say, well, okay, they can also decide what they pay for. But,
absolutely.
But yeah.
As long as it doesn't violate their nonprofit status.
Well, that is true, or it doesn't violate what they think is reasonable, right? I mean, that's also.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I will say this. I generally agree with Chuck on this, but like it or not, vibe coding is a portion of the future of development.
Yes.
To completely ignore it and try to not make it better is to and the rest of the development community's detriment.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, that exact same statement has come up so many times in the printing and publishing industry all those years ago. And in many cases, it was the letter set experts that were pushing back, like very aggressively, against the desktop publishing world. The ones in that space that learned how to use PageMaker and Quark Express.
Like me. Time.
Like you.
Yeah.
They were the ones that continued on in the industry and had and were much better at this than other people because they had a deeper understanding of how all the pieces really work.
Yeah.
And the ones that were like, nope, not going to do it, and this is wrong, you should never use PageMaker, which is a totally different discussion, and all the designers out there are laughing right now.
Yes. But
the ones that were completely resistant and drew that hard line and said never, they were the ones that ultimately were like, well, crap, I got to go find a job.
Yep.
Because they were out of work.
Yes.
Yeah. I will say this. There's a very similar line between traditional media and us back in the day in new media. They hated us. because we didn't fit in their nice little box.
Yeah. And I have on InSpace a whole community of people right now that are vibe coding in different levels, right? There's developers or people in, let's say, the ID industry that have some experience. There's people that have, I mean, they all have some tech like interest, because otherwise they wouldn't have the Vision Pro. But like very different levels. But I think all of that is valid, and it's really interesting to see the things that they're creating. And that's why I lean on the side to say this is hostile, because I mean, yes, it is their decision, but I think it's also it's the typical exclusionary like group mentality that we get in the IT industry, where it's like, you are not the right kind of developer, and that's why I'm not accepting you.
And how many of those vibe coders will get the coding bug and want to learn like Swift or C++?
Yes, exactly. There will be some that move, that start that way and then move on and learn and grow. And there will be some that, scratch the itch, next, and move on. That's pretty typical. Like, that's how everybody, like some people got into development, and some people scripted a little bit and then were like, it's not my thing, and just moved on. It's the same path.
Right. Okay, so this is going to be a little controversial, but why not?
Why not?
So is this an opportunity? Yeah, is this not an opportunity for the vibe coders to say, okay, fine, you don't want us, we're going to go over here. And by the way, don't you come knocking on our door when you want in.
Yeah.
Yes,
you know, true. And so, some ways, maybe this is healthy, because maybe the vibe coders will be, maybe the vibe coders are not the future, but they're an important part of the future. Ben, to your point, like the digital media was to the world as it is today.
Yeah.
And the old guard has had to bend a lot because of the digital, the new media.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
The old guard is dying.
And that could happen as well.
Mm-hmm. The old guard is, I mean, I grant you, they're very ill. I don't know if it's terminal yet or not. But.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yep. So speaking of terminals, let's get on to our drop today. And Chuck, your gate is up for your pick.
Okay, so you did there.
Yeah, that was cute. That was cute. Okay, so this deserves just a real quick story, because I came back from MacStock. I had a few too much weight in my luggage, so I had to buy another bag and get everything home. So, and of course, unfortunately, because I bought it, I didn't have an AirTag with me to put in that, because my AirTags were already done. That would have solved the problem. The bag got lost. Typical. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. So I went through the process, started the initiative. Every day I got a text from Southwest, still looking for your bag, still looking for your bag, still looking for your bag. 5 days later, we still haven't found your bag. You know, would you like to start the claim process? And I was right ready to do that when I got another text. We found your bag. It's in Chicago, and it's being sent to Baltimore.
Nice.
So I called the baggage office in Baltimore. They found it. They opened up, told me what was in it. They told me some. I told them some. Yes, it's my bag, confirmed. By the way, it did not hurt that the bag was a MacStock, one of the MacStock duffel bags that had MacStock stenciled across it. Made it a lot more identifiable.
And that you didn't have so much to drink that you couldn't remember it.
Right, yeah. So just now, that was the success part of the story. The fail part is that Southwest said, great, you can either come and pick it up and we'll give you a voucher for travel, or we can just FedEx it to you overnight. Fine, FedEx it to me. I'd already thought that, this bag is gone and the contents are gone. And so FedEx... It's registered as deliver overnight priority. It got here 2.5 days later.
Yeah, that's FedEx.
You remember when FedEx used to be really reliable?
Yeah.
I know it was a really
long time ago. Really has to be there.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. But
and so now they're UPS Junior.
Right. But so but I have to say, the reason I brought this up is my drop is Southwest really I was impressed because I thought, sure, you know, this is one of those little gladiating things. We're looking, you know, we didn't find it. And then after a period of time that I really had given up and thought, okay, I'll start the claim process and see if I can get some money back for what I lost. They came through. So it means a lot. It also taught me that I'm going to travel with an extra AirTag in the event this happens again.
Yes. That's smart.
You know, but well, and it was one of those things that I really never expected to need to be bringing home that much stuff from Max.
The one time you had an extra bag that didn't have an AirTag is actually when you needed it.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's my story and that's my drop and fly Southwest.
Very cool.
Oh, if they weren't 3.5 hours away at Midway, I definitely would. So, Jeff, I have a question for you.
Ben, I would love to hear your question.
What cable?
That cable. And that's exactly right. Okay. So, what cable? I think this is an important enough pick or drop that even though I talked about this as we record last night on In Touch with iOS, I'm talking about it again today because more people need to know about what cable. So this is an app that you run on your Mac, and there's a Windows version as well. I can't remember if there's Linux. If there is, I'm totally putting it on my MacBook that's running Mint. But I've got it on my Mac. What this does is it detects what cable you have plugged in to whatever port it's plugged into, and it gives you all the data it can about the cable. So if it has an eChip in it, then it can give you data like even down to the manufacturer of the cable. So you can figure out if a cable has the bandwidth that you think it does, what sort of wattage or voltage it can run through, if it's causing limitations with any devices that are connected, and in a case like mine where I have a dock with a Thunderbolt dock with like 3 USB hubs connected to it, and all of these different devices. It's super great for me when something isn't working right, because it helps me narrow down where that problem is. And and I even realized last night, as I was talking about this on In Touch with iOS, that one of the problems that I've had for a very long time didn't even occur to me it might be the cable. And it's that this microphone right here, I'm using a Rode Podcaster, it connects via USB. I've never been able to plug it into a hub or a dock. The cable that I'm using may actually be the reason why. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to get another USB cable and try that out and see if that fixes the problem. Yeah. But it wasn't until I was looking in WhatsApp last night using my microphone as an example where it's like, oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
So this isn't matching up.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think it's available on Windows, and it is not available on Intel Macs either, because the Intel Macs have older Thunderbolt chips or have different Thunderbolt chips that do not expose that information. So you need a Apple Silicon M1 or later, and Sonoma or later. Yes.
Having that same microphone, I think it's a USB-B. It's like the old printer.
Yeah, it's a USB connectors. B to cable. Yeah.
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 Very cool. Already downloaded.
Yep. So
you can use it for free, and it'll give you pretty much everything you need. Now, Patrice, I know you, and you're super smart, which means you will probably end up wanting to pay for
$10 bucks. Yes. Yes. I'm probably by the end of the show, I'll already have paid the $10.
Yes. Yeah. I installed it. And or download and install it while we're talking. This is what it already tells me. I have a USB 2 device, the 2.4 gigahertz dongle for a device, plugged into one of my Thunderbolt ports. My my Mac does not use the full bandwidth of the Thunderbolt cable that is attached because I have a M1 Pro MacBook Pro, and it's going a Thunderbolt 5 cable going to a Thunderbolt 5 dock. It says my external display is running at full resolution coming out of that dock. Yeah, this thing is pretty incredible.
It's super awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yep. So get what cable? Not to be confused with WhatsApp. Yep. So, Marty, your pick has gotten a little deep purple in my head. So tell us about your highway at Doc Star.
Yeah, Doc Star. I follow Reddit and apps come up under Mac apps there. And this one came up and I thought I'd play with it a little bit. And frankly, it's done two things for me. Doc Star basically allows you, I guess the best way to describe it is create widgets that you can program each of the little pieces of the widget with an application or what this has opened up for me is the idea of using shortcuts. Because one of the things it can do is open up shortcuts. So what I've done is it allows you to create these little widget docs all over your screen if you choose to. And I have a doc now that has the order of the apps that I run when I am processing a podcast or video cast. So, you know, open Ecamm Live folder, open podcast work folder, so I can move that from Ecamm Live into that. Open Adobe Audition, so I can grab the audio out of it first. Open Adobe Premiere, then use Levelator, use TimeBolt. These are all apps that are in the sequence of what I use when I am editing a podcast or a vodcast. It's now in one nice little doc hanging up on the right. So I have to go around on the bottom and remember the sequence. It's already there. But what it came to some points where it's like, well, I want it to do this. And it said, well, you can add a snippet or a shortcut in there. And then I had to open up shortcuts for the first time in a long time. And the new version of shortcuts is amazing in terms of saying, not being a programmer, I do pay for the programs that I buy. I respect programmers that way. Mm-hmm. So, I pay for my product. But being able to type in, I want you to open this folder and then have it create a snippet for it that I could then put in my doc as part of my work sequence was just phenomenal. So I'm still playing with it. It was the bright spot of my day, one that I was able to figure this out, and it seems usable. And second, that it now it's got me into shortcuts and how easy they are to create. Mm-hmm. So
very
take cool. a look at it. Yeah,
that sounds awesome. And I think
I think it's a $20 one-time fee, and I did check the release notes on it, and this person is doing really, I mean, the latest release was June 10th, then prior to that, January 14th, then we go back next year to November 20th. So this is not a developer that's just dropping the stuff, you know?
It's important.
This is really interesting, Marty. I'm just looking at it. I'm not familiar with this at all. It feels like it has components of Moom and Yoink, both.
Yeah.
Great. There's this another
truly looks awesome. So, Patrice, I believe you have a camera to tell us about.
Yes. I actually have two cameras to tell you about. So, I previously used one of these Aquara G3 cameras. Really cool, oh, HomeKit compatible. They're really cute. I have this is the privacy mode, so it looks like a little cat. Worked well for about 2 years, and then it just one day to another, it just completely broke. Just died. I don't know what happened. I was like, should I buy another one? They haven't changed in a couple of years. I'm like, I don't know. The app is not great. So I looked, and I remembered that a certain Jeff Gamet had told me about this company. So I bought a Eufy camera. I didn't just buy one Eufy camera. I bought two because they have two packs. So this is the E30. And it works really well. Like, it has a really good app. It has full, which was important for me, HomeKit integration. It has Matter and whatever, like all of that stuff I need. It doesn't store anything in the cloud. They have a cloud mode if you want to pay for it, but you don't need to. You can also put a micro SD card in it and it stores it on that. So they basically got everything, and they're not expensive. I think the two pack was, what was it? $120, 120 euros, something like that. So works well, works with all platforms, works with HomeKit, of course, but it also, like I said, it's Matter. You can use it with Google. So I got those two, one in the entrance, one in the living room.
Yep. And for those not aware, Eufy is the smart home division of Anker.
Yes.
And throughout all their divisions, Anker is known for developing, for giving you high quality product. Yes. At a really reasonable price.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Comes with a USB cable and a chart and everything. It can be mounted on the wall, upside down, whatever you want. It tilts and pans and all of that. So all you need. Those two.
I keep looking at this one. So Patrice, the camera that I'm running right now, is a Eufy. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember which model it is. I've had it for a few years.
Yeah.
And it's a stationary camera.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it works great. But in my old place, I had a Wyze camera set up that would do the whole tracking and tilt and stuff. Yeah. And I keep thinking, man, I'd really like that. But maybe this is the answer. You know how offline we're having the discussion about my broken HomeKit woes? So getting a camera, that would trigger the whole process of me abandoning HomeKit completely.
Jeff's the same here.
I know. It's, you know, I look at that, I'm like, $69. Oh, but then I'm going to have to set up another Raspberry Pi for Home Assistant and start from scratch. And because, of course, I would set up a Pi for that.
Yeah, I have Home Assistant running behind me as well. So,
yeah.
I'm still trying to figure out when we don't talk about your HomeKit online.
When it's solved.
When it's solved, that's when I'll shut up.
So, Apple, get onto it.
Never.
Yeah, and Marty, honestly, I'll probably stop talking about it when enough of the stuff on my current smart home setup on HomeKit stops working because I can't add anything.
Just go analog and press the switch.
I do that a lot.
Yeah, like a caveman.
Like a freaking caveman.
Yeah. You know what, Jeff? I was thinking about you the other day in relation to your HomePod issues. And I thought, I bet it's listening to you and hears you griping and criticizing it all the time. Maybe if you were nicer to it, it would behave itself.
Maybe if it behaved itself, I could be nicer.
Yeah. As a marriage counselor, I have heard that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I openly admit that I have a very dysfunctional relationship with my smart home technology.
We're going to open up a GoFundMe for Jeff's tech therapy.
Now, Marty, you know the cycle. You know, it's good, it degrades, it gets bad. You apologize. I promise it'll be better. It's good, it gets bad.
But the makeup tech is incredible.
It is. And, you know, and every time that I've had to like completely nuke HomeKit and start from scratch, yeah, afterwards it's like, oh, this is so freaking great. Even though it took me 3 weeks to reconstruct everything that, you know, all the automations and everything that I had to destroy. This is so great. Everything works. It's going to be great this time.
Mm-hmm. And you know what, Jeff? Let's talk about some tech that I have a wonderful relationship
with. I want to hear about happy, fun, wonderful relationships.
Yep. So a number of months ago, I bought this little bad boy. It is the 8-bit DO, however you want to pronounce it, wireless 2, or Ultimate 2 Wireless. What Chang edition? Sorry for anybody who actually speaks Chinese. I've heard the game is awesome. I just don't know how to pronounce it correctly. Fantastic controller, TMR sticks. It's the best controller I've ever used. Well, for my upstairs, I have been using an AmberNIC controller. Really, really, also really well made. Well, the problem is, it wants to reverse the functionality of the BNA sticks.
I hate when my BNA sticks get backwards.
Both buttons. So I decided it was time to retire that when I saw this. This is also the Ultimate 2 Wireless. They officially call this the N64 30th anniversary edition. Do you want to know what I call this?
The Bondi Blue edition?
Exactly.
Yay, I knew it. It looks like it.
Yeah. I'm going to turn it on and hope it's... this thing is... It has all sorts of colors.
Shiny. It even lights up.
Yeah, completely transparent.
Nice.
It has both Bluetooth and 2.4 gigahertz wireless connectivity. The TMR sticks are some of the best I have ever played with. This is compatible with the full gamut of Apple devices. Literally, I play this with my bedroom Apple TV, which I have to admit now, there are some really decent games now on Apple Arcade. Yes, Patrice, we know about that. they're $60, frequently on sale, available in a lot of other colors, so I highly recommend it. It's also available with Windows, Android, and Steam. With that, I will shut up because one of our hosts has to vamoose. And we will start with the Lord of Only Checks and Polos, Mr. Chuck Joyner. Tell us about yourself and where we can find.
You can find everything I'm doing at macvoices.com. We do a live show Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, youtube.com/macvoicesTV. And on the socials, you'll find me as at Chuck Joyner. Any other time, you might find me sitting back behind me vibe coding.
Yeah.
Cool. Mr. Marty Gentius, the man of 10,000 podcasts.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to make it simple. First of all, I get the pleasure of being on Chuck's show on Tuesday nights, Dave's show on Thursday nights, and this show, which is just like a whole different kind of vibe, which I really enjoy on Friday mornings. But my stuff, you can find shows like Vision Profiles and the Neo Notebook and Fade to Chat. All of that you can find at the website, thepodtalk.net. And it'll have connections to the stuff that I do. Please go check out some shows, subscribe, give me a like. That's the only way. I'm not making money, so that's the only kind of good feeling I get inside when those things happen. So take a look at the shows and have some fun with it. You can connect with me at Gencius, J-E-N-C-I-U-S, on all the socials.
Paid the chat. I like the Metallica reference.
Oh, I didn't catch the Metallica reference.
Fade to Black.
Yeah, that was actually a cinema reference. But yeah, okay.
Next, we have Mr. Jeff Dammit. I'm in camp.
I see what you did there. All right.
Oh, so, I've been waiting years for that, Jeff. It's,
you know, I get it. You played the long tail game there. And well done, sir. Let's see. How about my blogs? JeffGammit.com, FreshBrewTales.com. And, of course, a shout-out for my merch that you can get now, JeffGammit.com/merch. And thank you to everyone that's been buying Borb T-shirts and mugs. And
that's so cool.
I love it. Thank you. Okay. Then social media, Jay Gammit everywhere. And almost everywhere, Jeff Gammit on LinkedIn. I still don't know why I set it up that way. Anyhow, then shows, Tuesdays on Chuck's Mac Voices Live, Thursdays on Dave Ginsberg's In Touch with iOS. Brian Chaffin and I do The Context Machine. Patrice and I do Retro Rewatch. Here we are on Tech Hangout. And I'll stop there because there's more, but other people still need to talk.
Yes. Like Patrice Brendamore.
Yes. Thanks. It was fun, as always. Jeff and I, as Jeff just mentioned, Jeff Dammit, we do Retro Rewatch together. And it's a really fun show. We talk about TV shows. We basically just wrapped up, or we just published the final episode of season 4 of Stargate SG-1, Exodus, last week, and I think should already be out or should be out shortly. I scheduled it. I just don't remember for what time. The recap of season 4 of Stargate SG-1. So that kind of wraps up our coverage. And next week, then, there's a very special episode coming with a very special person. And stay tuned for that. So it's coming up next week. And everything else.
And the recap is out.
The recap is out. Okay, I thought I had published it somewhere in the morning. Everything else I'm doing on my website, thepatrice.com.
It better be teal.
No. But it's almost as cool.
Indeed.
Indeed.
With that, I have been your host, Ben Raythig. You can find me at Ben Raythig on social media. RaythigTech.com for my writings and ravings, and every Friday here on the Tech Hangout in the panel and here hosting. With that, that has been episode 7 for July 24th, 2026 of the Tech Hangout. We'll see you next tech time, next same tech channel.